From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the funerals continue in Pittsburgh. And amidst the mourning, parents are struggling with a big question: how to talk to kids about shootings driven by hate.
We have to confront the fact that if they've heard about this, they may be afraid to go into the synagogue. Now it's a place that a gunman walked in and started shooting up people.
Also, Massport CEO Thomas Glynn prepares to step down.
We're very proud of the international flight growth. I think the revitalization of Worcester Airport is a very big deal to people in Central Mass. And then the revitalization of the working port.
And celebrating the Red Sox.
When are you going to be able to experience a parade on Halloween and, of course, celebrating the Red Sox?
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. The Red Sox rolled out the duck boats today, and tens of thousands of fans joined the team in celebrating the World Series win over the Los Angeles Dodgers during a victory parade. One fan, Jermaine Pullum, has been to several Patriots and Red Sox parades and took off work today to be sure he wouldn't miss this one. He says the celebrations never get old.
Oh my gosh, the atmosphere, the energy. It feels like it's becoming a tradition to come because we win so much now. It's like, you know, every season it's like, get prepared to come down to the parade because we're most likely to win something out here. It's great.
Young fans were excited to see their favorite players rolling through the streets. And for many of their parents, it was another chance to celebrate in a way they didn't while growing up during the Sox 86-year dry spell. Here's Jody Meltzer-Darter, who says she's been going to Red Sox games since she was a little girl. She brought her 8-year-old son Alex with her to the parade.
This is really hard-earned, this celebratory period since 2000, obviously. And it's just incredible to be here with my 8-year-old and have him experience this, because it certainly wasn't my childhood.
So there's definitely a lot for the Red Sox fans to be happy about today. And as the celebrations continue, we'll be reflecting on the success of this particular Red Sox team, one that some are calling the greatest of all time. And here with me to talk about this Red Sox team is the team's historian, Gordon Eads. Gordon, thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure, Callum.
Gordon, how was the parade? You covered some of these as a reporter, but you got to ride along this time as part of the team. How was that?
Yeah, it's a bit of a different experience when you're actually on the duck boat. And you know, it's funny, Callum, I was riding on a duck boat with members of the Red Sox front office. So you're thinking, okay, the players are going to, of course, be showered with adulation and all that. And we go by and you're going to think that people are looking in there and going, huh? But you haven't lived until you've heard a chant of front office, front office. I mean, these fans were happy to see anybody related to the ball club, and it was great fun.
Well, but that is the one constant, right? Because the players, the coaches, that's all changed since 2004, but the ownership group is the same.
Well, you know, it's funny, Callum. I was contemplating that this morning in advance of coming on with you, and I was thinking about the Patriots and their 5 Super Bowls in the 21st century and the 3 primary components have been, you know, Bill Belichick, Tom Brady, and owner Bob Kraft year after year after year. In our case, the 4 World Series, you know, we've won 4 World Series with 3 different managers, Terry Francona in 04 and 07, then John Farrell 2013, and now Alex Cora. 3 different general managers, Theo Epstein, Ben Cherington, and now Dave Dombrowski. David Ortiz was the constant for the thread that ran through the first 3 World Series, but he's been gone. So really, the one constant in the Red Sox experience has been the ownership of John Henry and Tom Werner. And I know those guys sign my checks, but I mean, you do have to give credit where credit is due. And they transform the culture here.
So put your historian hat on now, Gordon. That's your new job. And so where does this team stack up in franchise history? They won the most games, but does that make them the best in team history? What about that 04 team, Gordon? They broke the streak.
Well, and that's right. And the thing is, Callum, if this club had just set the regular season franchise record of 108 victories, that would not have been enough to give them that imprimatur of best team ever.
They'd be the 07 Patriots.
That's a very apt analogy. And in this case, they were required to become the first team in baseball history to beat two 100 victory teams, the Yankees and the Astros, just to get to the World Series. And for them to win 11 out of 14, I mean, it's 7-1 on the road in the postseason is just mind-boggling. And you know, you think to yourself, well, the 2004 team, and if you want to go player by player down the lineups, you might make a case that the 04 team was better because you've got Hall of Famers in Pedro Martinez, Curt Schilling, borderline Hall of Famer. David Ortiz is almost certainly going to go in, and if Manny hadn't taken fertility drugs, he'd be going in as well. And the 04 team took the pressure off all subsequent Red Sox teams. But from top to bottom and in terms of, I mean, this team this year never lost more than three consecutive games all season. They went wire to wire. I mean, they even won in spring training when it doesn't count. They won over 20 games in spring training, came out of the chute 17-2, finished strong, and then just dominated in the postseason. That 04 team came within, as you well remember, one strike of being eliminated before they even advanced to the World Series.
All right, so take a tea break, nurse that that hoarse parade voice of yours, and let me ask you this. You had a lot of big stars on this team, obviously, some young stars, Mookie Betts, but you also had Andrew Benintendi really emerging. And then there were the guys who sort of surprised us a little bit. I'm thinking of Steve Pearce, who was the series MVP. And I'm thinking of David Price, who was a big star, certainly during the regular season, but had a long history of choking in October. How much of a surprise was that to you to see those guys step up?
Think about Steve Pearce for a second. This is a guy who played for seven different major league teams. One team, the Baltimore Orioles, three times. He played for twice that number of minor league teams in the course of his career. He's never had more than 400 plate appearances in any season. Dave Dombrowski picks him up in a trade with Toronto for a low-level minor leaguer and cash, platoon player, and he ends up becoming World Series MVP. That's insane. Obviously, we've had Octobers where obscure players have stepped into the limelight. I think even in the Red Sox history, Bobby Keelty was a part-time player who had a big pinch hit home run in the deciding game of the 2007 World Series, or Bernie Carbo, who had the great home run in Game 6 of the 75 Series. But I looked at the list of the World Series MVPs since they started giving the award in 1955. None of them have been as well-traveled as Steve Pearce. He said, you know, I look at my career as a journey, and funny things happen in baseball. And if you hang around long enough, some pretty special things can happen. This was very special.
So Pearce was a great roster move by Dombrowski during the season. And during the postseason, we saw some really good in-game moves by the manager, Alex Cora. First-year manager, Gordon, how big a role, how much credit does he deserve for this title?
I think you can't give Alex Cora enough credit for what took place this season. And you know, he wowed our front office from his first interview for the job back last November, about this time after serving as bench coach for the Houston Astros. It was apparent in spring training that the players bought into his approach. You know, Alex created an environment where I think you heard a lot of players talk about there was a certain joylessness to playing through last year. There was an inability to get by those plateaus and lows that inevitably are part of every season. Although this season doesn't appear to have had very many lows. These players trusted Alex. He showed a knack, you know, and maybe it's because I think there's a couple of reasons. One, he played in Boston before. He was here and experienced highs and lows, played for a team that missed the playoffs, was also on the 07 series winning team. So he knew the territory. He knows how to deal with the pressures of playing in Boston. And I think the fact that he's not that far removed from his own playing career and had the experience of being bench coach in Houston last year, that really sharpened his ability to communicate with those guys that play for him.
So you know how this goes in Boston now, Gordon. The parade is over, and we already look ahead to the next one. When are we going to win the next one? So in the few seconds we have left, this team looks loaded for next year. And, oh, by the way, Dustin Pedroia comes back. What's the outlook going forward?
Yeah, and, you know, there was actually some news this morning, Callum. It's not official, but David Price, who you alluded to earlier, and who, you know, exercised all of his postseason demons this year, pitching the World Series clincher and the ALCS clincher, he has indicated that he is going to pick up his option, or he's not going to exercise his option. He will stay here in Boston for the remainder of his career. You love the young core, Callum. There's no reason to think that this team isn't going to be that perennial contender for the next several years.
That's what we'd like to hear, Gordon. Thanks for coming in. We really appreciate it. Red Sox historian Gordon Eads joining us in the studio.
Thank you.
All right, Massachusetts is a state of older moms. The average age of a first-time mother here is the highest in the nation, almost 31, according to the CDC. Waiting to have your first child later in life can add pressure to have a second, if you want one, soon after. WBUR Common Health editor Carrie Goldberg spoke with Maria Garcia about some new research on pregnancy spacing and health risks.
So, Carrie, pregnancy spacing, and what is the official recommended time between babies?
So, generally, new moms are advised to wait a couple of years or at least 18 months after having one baby before getting pregnant with the next one. And that's because there's quite a bit of evidence that both the baby and the mom are at heightened risk of various problems, including even death, although that's, of course, very rare, if the mom doesn't wait.
So you're told to wait 18 months at least. But if you're an older mom, you've also got to think about, you know, that proverbial biological clock.
Yeah, tick, tick, tick. And you don't know where you are on the road to that fertility cliff that everybody goes over at some point. So for anyone who has faced or will face that dilemma, a new paper in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine could add, I think, some helpful data points. It's work done while the lead author, who is University of British Columbia epidemiologist Laura Schumers, was here at Harvard. And it looks at 10 years of data on nearly 150,000 pregnancies in Canada. So these are women who had good access to healthcare in a developed country. And here's how Schumer sums up what they found.
For women of all ages, pregnancies conceived within 12 months after a live birth have increased risks. We further found that risks to the mother were there for older women, and risks to the baby were there for women of all ages.
So in other words, the added risks to the babies were higher among younger moms, and the risks to the mothers were higher among older moms. In fact, only older women incurred higher risks to their own health by getting pregnant again very soon.
Okay, so Carrie, help us make better sense of this. Why are there these increased risks?
So there actually is a debate among researchers about why short intervals between pregnancies are linked to health risks. Is the short interval an actual biological cause? Like, is the mother's body depleted of essential nutrients or something? Or does it reflect other causes, like a lack of access to healthcare, more unintended pregnancies? Because, you know, Maria, let's face it, most women don't want to have another baby right away because we're totally exhausted. But in short, we're not sure. But this study specifically looked at older moms who tend to have better access to healthcare and fewer unintended pregnancies.
And did they still incur those extra risks by having babies closer together?
So, yes. But first of all, we need to put the usual caveat out there, which is talk to your doctor. You never want to do anything based on just one study. But yes, Laura Schumer says, you know, those extra risks were still there for both mother and baby. But she also says there's also some good news here for older moms in a hurry.
The optimal spacing window that we found was 1 to 2 years after the delivery of one child until the conception of the next pregnancy. And in that 1 to 2 year window, that's when we found the lowest risks for both mothers and babies. And the reason this is good news is that waiting to achieve a 12 to 24 month period between birth and conception is actually fairly short.
Now, if you're 36 or 37 or 38, it may not seem short to you, but some previous studies have suggested that the optimal interval may be quite a bit longer, at least 18 months and up to 5 years. Mm-hmm. So the good news is that you don't have to wait too much longer, though the frustrating news is that there really are added risks at 6 months and up to 12 months.
But Carrie, put those risks in perspective for us. What actually are the risks and how much do they go up by age?
So I'm glad you asked that, Maria, because it's a really important point. What we call the absolute risks are very small, even though the relative risks, you know, the proportional changes, are not that small. So let's say you have 1,000 mothers and they're all over 35. If they all wait the recommended year and a half to have another baby, about 3 of those 1,000 women will get seriously ill or die. If they're in a rush and get pregnant again within a half a year, 6 of the 1,000 will get seriously ill or die.
So overall, very few cases, but a very dire outcome,
right,
and a doubling of that risk, right, essentially. So what about risks to the baby?
So let's again take 1,000 moms over age 35. And now we're looking at what's called a severe adverse infant outcome, which means stillbirth or the baby's born very early or very small. So if the moms all wait the recommended year and a half to get pregnant again, 18 of the 1,000 births will have severe outcomes for the baby. If they don't wait and get pregnant again very quickly, it goes up to 21 severe infant outcomes.
Well, we certainly don't want to minimize that impact.
No.
It is a difference, but not a very big one, relatively speaking. And
right,
outcomes for younger moms, Carrie?
So that's where there's a bigger difference in how the babies do. Again, we take that 1,000 moms, but these are ages 20 to 34. If they wait the recommended year and a half, 14 of the 1,000 births have severe infant outcomes. If they don't wait, it's 20 per 1,000. Here's epidemiologist Laura Schumers again.
This shows you both the relationship between pregnancy spacing and the increased risk, but also that older women tend to have a higher baseline risk of many of these outcomes at all pregnancy spacing lengths.
So, Maria, bottom line is, of course, as we know, it's an incredibly personal decision whether to have a baby, when to have a baby, when to have a second baby. And Schumer says her research team just hopes this new study can help women make these decisions within their own personal context and, of course, in consultation with their medical teams. But she says this new data may be particularly helpful for older women because we more often decide to have short pregnancy intervals on purpose.
That's Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health, speaking with Maria Garcia. Listeners, you can find a link to Carrie's post on this research at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, how should we talk to children about tragedies like the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh? I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. In Pittsburgh today, funerals continue for the victims of Saturday's mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue. Joyce Feinberg, 75, Irving Younger, 69, and Melvin Wax, 87, were memorialized earlier this afternoon. There were 3 funerals yesterday also, with hundreds of people out to show their support. Along with mourning, adults are struggling with how to talk about what happened in Pittsburgh with their children. Linda K. Wertheimer wrote about that for WBUR's Cognoscenti. She's the author of Faith Ed, Teaching About Religion in an Age of Intolerance. Linda, thanks for coming in during a really difficult time.
Thank you so much, Cal.
And on the line with us is Dr. Jean Burrison, the executive director of the MGH Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds and a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Hi, Dr. Burrison.
Hi, glad to be with you.
Linda, I want to start with you. And again, I'm so sorry that you're in the position of having to have these conversations. Your essay for WBUR is called What Do We Tell Our Jewish Children About the Pittsburgh Shootings? So tell us, what did you tell your son?
So I first started very, very simply. And we were in the car on the way back from figure skating practice, believe it or not. And I had known that it happened, and I really wanted to know more, so I wanted to turn on the radio. And so I decided that I would tell him a little bit. And what I said was, you know, something really bad happened, that, you know, a man went into a synagogue, and he shot people, and he killed them. And we're going to listen to a little bit of the news, not a lot, just so we can hear a little bit more. And then I want to hear what your questions are, and we can go a little bit more from there. So I turned on the news, and he heard a little bit more. And he didn't really have any questions right off. But that's kind of how I started, like, really simply. And then when he started talking, you know, he said at some point, you know, Mom, I don't really think – I mean, the quote's in my story, but like he was like, you know, Mom, I really don't think this would happen in Lexington because we are diverse. You know, we have a lot of different religions and people are accepting. And that sort of like – that was the hardest moment for me when he said that. And Simon, I'm sorry if I'm not quoting you 100% correctly here, but because you don't want to burst your child's bubble. But he was even around, though, a couple years ago when there was an incident at Lexington High School and there was a swastika on one of the bathrooms and we took him to a vigil. So he was somewhat aware anyway that there's some anti-Semitism in the world, but this was a whole different ballgame. And so I was like, well, so how do I respond to that? And what I said was, it really can happen anywhere, but you don't need to be afraid. So I was trying to sort of juggle being realistic but also comforting him because it is really rare. I mean, this is a tragedy. It's a Jewish tragedy. It's an American tragedy. But it doesn't happen every day. And I don't really believe that should be afraid every time he walks into our temple.
But that message that it could happen anywhere fits with this tragedy in Pittsburgh, right? We've heard a lot from folks from Pittsburgh that the Squirrel Hill neighborhood where this happened was one of the friendliest communities for Jewish people, and yet it happened there, right?
Right.
Jean, I want to bring you in, and I imagine that it could be tempting for parents and adults to want to just avoid talking about the shooting altogether. So I'm wondering why or if you think it's important to have this difficult conversation.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, first of all, it is difficult. But as parents have to understand that their kids are going to be exposed to media these days more than ever before. And I think we have to assume, you know, that all of our children, you know, toddlers, school-aged children, adolescents, young adults, have seen, heard, been exposed to something. And letting them sit with these kinds of powerful images and stories and voices can be very, very upsetting. It can, you know, we've known in other terrorist or school shootings that it can cause a traumatic stress response, it can cause anxiety, and they're going to have lots of questions. And I think that the parents really need to provide reassurance, support, guidance, and help the kids navigate these waters. The assumption is they're going to have heard this one way or another, and we don't want to have them worry alone. Nobody should worry alone.
But, Gene, do you try to moderate that in any way? I mean, do you try to turn off the TV or maybe even take away a smartphone so maybe you limit that exposure?
Yes. As a matter of fact, so the way I would think of it as a child psychiatrist, and I was going to ask you how old your kid.
Oh, he's only 10 years old,
okay.
And he does not have a cell phone, and we're not actually big TV watchers. We never leave the TV on with the news running. We get most of our news from NPR. This is not meant to be a big plug for NPR. So we may be a little atypical in that at this point he's not carrying around a smartphone. He doesn't have, you know, he does have access to a computer under supervision.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is that you raised, the reason I asked the question is because, and the question is this, I think as parents we have to approach very young children, infants, toddlers, you know, early school-age children, and basically turn everything off. School-age children will, like your 10-year-old, now you're much like my oldest daughter who didn't have screen time for their kids very much at all. But interestingly, they did get, you know, they go to, you know, a shopping mall, they go to school, they see a computer, they have a friend with a smartphone, they may get it one way or another. Which in our household was a real source of, you know, question, like how should they be exposed? Because she was very much like you, wanting to limit the screen time.
We actually do let him play video games, so.
Yeah, well, that's fine. You know, I mean, every family is different, but what I was getting at is that the approach to very young children, to school-age children, to teenagers, you know, so what do you do for like a 15, 18-year-old? And the approach has to be different. The discussion is different. I mean, so I would turn the TV off for folks out there who have TV computers, other screens on. For the very youngsters, turn it off. But they're going to hear you talking, and they're going to feel your feelings. That's another whole issue. For school-age children, really limit it, maybe a little bit, like you did, and then you know get a response. For teenagers, it's probably since they're able to understand more and more power, justice, prejudice, you know, the nuances of these things, and they feel them very deeply. They may need to actually watch a news broadcast, you know, a PBS show with the adult. Stop the TV, ask them questions, talk about it. But even before we let them see anything, I think the most important thing is to do kind of what you did, and that is to say, you know, what have you seen or heard? What do you make of it? What are your feelings or ideas about it? Because we need to respond to where they're coming from rather than just sitting them down and giving them a lecture, which no kid wants.
Linda, do you think those conversations are particularly different for or sensitive for Jewish children in particular? I mean, we're talking about this with all children, but there's a lot of history.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I did write in my essay that my husband is the son of a Holocaust survivor. It's not unusual for a Jewish family to have some connection to the Holocaust, to have had some relative or some descendant. But in our family, you know, we may have had some conversations about anti-Semitism earlier than most. But it is really but here's the thing. Why is it so particularly traumatic for the Jewish community in America right now? Part of it is because my kid goes to religious school 2 days a week. This is particularly for those of us who have some kind of connection to a Jewish institution. This happened in a Jewish institution. It happened at Shabbat services. So the idea that this place where we go to feel a second family, where it's like sanctuary, that's what's particularly traumatic. And I have friends who have yet to tell their children because they're so personally upset, angry, they don't know how they can do it without being so upset that their child's going to pick up on all their emotions. I would argue that they're going to pick up on your emotions anyway. And this is now part of our Jewish history, and we can't avoid talking about it. We can't wrap our kids in bubble wrap.
Is that okay, Jean, by the way, if you're a parent and you're feeling scared yourself and you're betraying that emotion in your conversation with your kids? I mean, is that all right, or are you going to traumatize them more by showing them that mommy and daddy are scared too?
Well, it's a very good point, and I number one, I think it is important to share your feelings because they will pick up on it, one way or another. But that being said, before parents actually talk with their kids, it's like when you're on the airplane, put the oxygen mask on yourself first, and then help the person next to you. The parents have to be, and all of the research and all the studies about talking about traumatic events. The parents need to take care of themselves first. So they have to put their finger on the pulse on what they're feeling, whether it's rage, upset, sadness, anxiety. Talk to people, be a part of a community. There are a lot of techniques that parents can do to control their own emotions to some extent. Once they're in control, we have a much better chance of guiding the conversation. But the kids will still pick up on it. They'll say, you know, mommy, daddy, you're so sad, or you're so angry, and then you can't lie. You have to be genuine. So it's important to point that out.
Jean, understandably, we've seen some temples and synagogues talk about adding more security in recent days. And I'm curious, from a psychiatrist's perspective, you know, does that make a child who's going to the temple feel safer, or is it more frightening to see? Oh, there must be so much danger because a police officer is here.
Well, there's no doubt that has to be explained, and there's no doubt that everybody who goes into a temple now is going to be feeling anxious, upset, scared. But hiding the feelings is even worse, because then it raises not just the kids are picking up on the emotions of the child, the kids are picking up on all of the feelings, but they're not being spoken. So one has to learn how to say, you know, this makes me very upset. You know, I get very upset, depending on how old a child is. You know, Jewish people have been oppressed for, as we talk about at Passover and other times, we have a history of this, and this plays right into my emotions. And yes, it makes me very sad. It makes me very angry, but it's rare. There are more good people in the world than bad people. We're doing everything we possibly can to make sure that everyone is going to be safe. And if there happens to be an officer in the front of the temple, and the reason the officer is there is to just be sure that we are feeling safe. So expressing your emotions is not inconsistent with expressing your feelings. I want to add one other thing to this conversation, and that while I'm a Jew, fortunately my family did not have a death in the Holocaust, but they had to leave Russia when the pogroms were slaughtering Jews, and they left prior to that, and my whole family knows about that situation. So it is particularly powerful for all Jewish people, but it also triggers other people in this particular climate, where immigrants of all kinds, murders in Kentucky. There's more violence. There are hate crimes are rare, but they're highly publicized in the media, and many, people of color, Latinos.
Can I jump in on this thought?
In just a few seconds, okay. We have left. Linda, yes, please.
Yeah, what I'd like to add is, yes, it's important as Jewish parents we talk to Jewish children, but it's also important that non-Jewish parents are talking to their children, that teachers are talking to older elementary kids about this. Yeah. I wrote this book called Faith Ed. It's about teaching about the world's religions in schools. And while this may not prevent a madman with a gun from entering a school, we can then prepare the next generation better to understand things like hate symbols and the words you use and who Jews are and who Christian, and who Muslims are and who blacks are. If we don't teach about these things to our children and we don't use these kinds of incidents as a teachable moment, it's a missed opportunity.
And certainly a big and important task. Yes. Linda K. Wertheimer is the author of Faith Ed, as she just mentioned, teaching about religion in an age of intolerance. Linda, thanks again for joining us in such a difficult time.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Jean Baresson is the executive director of the MGH Clay Center for Young and Healthy Minds and a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Baresson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, you can find links to pieces that both Linda and Jean wrote about the Pittsburgh shooting on our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. If I say Massport, chances are this comes to mind. But the public agency is so much more than just Logan Airport. It's a self-sustaining government agency that generates more than $600 million a year across three marine terminals, the Boston Waterfront, Logan Airport, Hanscom Field, and Worcester's Airport. And since 2012, Thomas Glynn has been at the helm. Now, after 6 years on the job, Glynn is stepping down as CEO of the Massachusetts Port Authority. But before he retires from that post, he joins us now in the studio. Thomas Glynn, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for inviting me.
I want to start with your time at Massport and your more recent job. In your 6 years at the agency, the region has experienced a lot of growth in air traffic, many more international flights coming in to Logan Airport, and also a lot of growth in shipping. So what would you consider to be the biggest accomplishment of Massport on your watch?
So I guess I would say three things. The growth of international flights, we've added 20 new destinations since I took over, and we've increased passengers by about 60, international passengers by about 60%. Second is the revitalization of the working port. About 7,000 blue-collar jobs exist in the working port, and I think we've gotten that back on track. And third, the growth of the Worcester Airport, which has always been an important potential way to take some traffic away from Logan and is now experiencing some pretty significant successes with major airlines, JetBlue, American, and Delta.
Couldn't we, though, just attribute that growth in air traffic to the humming economic engine that is New England right now? What has Massport done to deserve credit for all that that expansion?
No, that's a great question. So, you know, I think there's no question that the economy drives our success and is the major factor. I guess I'd like to think that with the various businesses, because we're kind of a public-private enterprise, the airlines are happy with the way we work with them, so they're willing to, you know, try to expand at Logan. The container shipping companies are happy with the way we work with them. So I think good management does play a role in the willingness of our private businesses to take advantage of the opportunities we offer. But the strong economy is definitely the key.
So we got a lot of travelers moving through Logan. They're not always happy, though, Tom. You know this. We've seen some J.D. Power studies on airport satisfaction. The most recent one from September ranked Logan near the bottom among the mega airports. J.D. Power said that Logan's a place where, quote, passenger disruption and increased traffic will be incredibly hard to avoid. What's your response to that?
So I think two things. First of all, if you look at the list, which we've done, you know, pretty much every year, it turns out that airports in the south and the west do a lot better than airports in the northeast. So even though they're not evaluating snow and storms, it has an impact on people's total experience in coming to the airport. And second, we've made a lot of improvements to the airport. In Terminal C is totally redesigned. We've added gates, an upgrade of the gates in Terminal E. We're doing a big project, which we're about to unveil, opens tomorrow in Terminal B. So people like the long-term benefit of those construction projects, but they feel disoriented by the construction while it's happening. And J.D. Power has explained that to us. So, you know, I think, you know, down the road when all these projects are completed, you know, we'll see the benefit. But in the short run, when construction is underway, you know, it's a little bit disorienting to folks.
So we got the construction. We got the weather to contend with, which you mentioned. What about Amazon, Tom? What if Amazon picks Boston for its second headquarters? And we expect a decision in the next couple of months, by the way.
Yep.
So is Logan and Massport more broadly prepared to handle the addition of what would be a 50,000-person workforce?
So we worked closely with the state officials and the mayor, governor on the GE exercise to kind of figure out. And I think we were seen as one of the positives in their decision making. We'd hope that Amazon, if they were to decide to come here, would see Logan as a positive. But I think you're raising an important question, you know, how to absorb 50,000 people, even if it's over a 10-year period, because we've had a lot of population growth in Boston over the last 10 years. So we're getting to a point, you know, where we really have to be very strategic and savvy about how to accommodate new growth.
So let's talk about Worcester. You mentioned them off the top.
Yep.
And now it's daily flights from JetBlue, American Airlines. Next year, Delta is coming aboard. So what impact will those flights have on the economy of Worcester?
So people in Worcester, I think, are very, very happy that we've had the success that we've had. And they feel like it's part of their success story. So if you go back, say, 15 or 20 years, about 400,000 people a year were using the Worcester Airport. So that's kind of a benchmark that we're shooting for. People don't always realize Worcester is the second biggest city in New England. So it's bigger than Providence, bigger than Manchester, bigger than Hartford. They all have airports. So we're very, you know, confident that the Worcester Airport will take off. And the airlines that you mentioned have, you know, looked at it as a business proposition, and they've gotten on board. So I think the growth in Central Mass and the growth in Worcester is, you know, is part of a big Massachusetts success story.
Do you think, though, that's a solution to budget woes? Because the Worcester Airport's been operating in the red. So what's the outlook there?
Well, the more flights they have, then the easier it is to cover the, you know, the operating nut and the capital nut. So, yeah, we think that there are more flights in the works and that ultimately it will be in a break even and then throw off a margin. But you have to make the investment, which we've made over the last 6 or 7 years.
I want to talk about a different money issue, the Massachusetts State Police overtime pay scandal. Troop F, as you know, of course, patrols Massport.
Yep.
The Boston Globe reported back in March that compensation for Troop F hadn't been reported to the state comptroller since 2010. And then when the figures were turned over, we found out that many of those troopers were drawing hefty paychecks, including one who made more than $300,000 for 3 years in a row. So I'm wondering what responsibility you believe Massport bears for that exorbitant overtime and then the lack of disclosure that went with it.
So, you know, I think that to take a step back, put this in context, in order to fully protect the airport, we need about 150 troopers assigned to Troop F. So back in the spring, we were looking at around 120. So when you don't have enough full-time staff, the only solution is to use overtime. And all of our posts are mandatory. We don't have a lot of discretionary posts. You know, the TSA checkpoints have to have somebody assigned to them. So that drove the numbers up because we didn't have enough full-time folks. I think that, the governor, jumped on top of this and the state police have jumped on top of this and they've tried to straighten out, a number of the things that you identified. But obviously it's been, it's been a kind of a black eye that we're hoping to get beyond.
But was it up to the state police, though, to do that reporting or should Massport have been doing it?
Well, they are state police employees. So ultimately, I think that's, an important part of the balancing act.
Although Massport at the time was paying the troopers directly, right? That's changed since the spring, right?
We changed that because a system had been designed in the 70s and it hadn't really been reviewed. So when we looked at it, we said, well, that doesn't really make sense. It just, leads to the opportunity for confusion.
So how about development? We think about transportation, of course, yep. With your agency, but you've played a big role in development, particularly in the seaport, too. And I'm thinking about the Omni Hotel project, which began construction earlier this year. And Massport notably used diversity as one part of the scoring process when picking the winning bidder for that project. Is that something Massport is going to continue to do? And what were those diversity factors?
So we tried a different approach. The chairman of our real estate committee on the board, Dwayne Jackson, and kind of initiated some creative thinking about this. So basically, we said to the six people who bid, there's 100 points. You get 25 points for finance, 25 points for design, 25 points for execution, and 25 points for diversity. So we let them decide how they wanted to do that. And they were kind of competing against each other, which is kind of different than the traditional approach. So we ended up with a big success with Omni, with a great diversity component that they generated, and we said, well, that was successful, so we're going to do it again. So we just put out last summer an RFP for another parcel, parcel A2, for an office building. We use the same criteria, 100 points, 25 points for diversity. We got 12 bids. We narrowed it down to 7, then 4, then 2. So it seems to work in the Seaport District. And, we're very happy because it isn't just employees in the construction trades. It's the investors, it's the architects, it's the managers. So we're really trying to, make sure the table is big enough to reflect the diversity of the Boston economy and not just have the same folks over and over again, win these bids.
I do want to ask you a bit about your old job.
Sure.
You previously headed the MBTA during the Dukakis administration.
I did.
And as you know, after the high-profile failures of that system during Snowmageddon a few years ago, we all remember this, the public scrutiny turned to decades of underinvestment and maintenance. And so I'm wondering now whether you think the investments made since 2015 and Governor Baker's Make It Work mantra is what the MBTA needs.
Well, I think they're on the road in a very dramatic way. Any of these big 100-year-old systems, when I worked at the MBTA in the early 90s, there was a blacksmith because some parts had to be manufactured because they were no longer available. So I think you just have to recognize a 100-year-old system. I think all the changes that have been made, have been beneficial. Some changes were made in the financing in the 90s that, maybe if we had to do over again, we'd say, well, maybe that wasn't the best way to restructure the financing. But nonetheless, that happened. So I think they're on the road to recovery. But, a million people depend on it every day. And, they get frustrated, as they should, for any kind of an interruption and if they're late to work. So it's a big public responsibility. And, people are kind of looking over their shoulders, as they should. But I think everything that I've seen is very positive. And I think people will be happy in the long run. But, they're living in the short run. So you have a lot of frustration.
Thomas Glynn is the CEO of Massport. He's believed stepping down from that post next month. Tom, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Finally today, since tonight is All Hallows' Eve, let's check in on poet Edgar Allan Poe. The Boston native is buried down in Baltimore, but he came back to life recently at Cambridge's Mount Auburn Cemetery.
So right now I've got a tablecloth that I'm putting together just to add a little splash of color. A little red seems appropriate. Some book-like objects, and I've got a fake inkwell with a raven feather hanging out of it. So my name is Rob Villela. I'm an Edgar Allan Poe living history performer. I've been performing Poe for about 9 years now.
Though he was born in Boston, Poe considered himself a Southerner, and he was often at odds with the Boston literati, many of whom are buried at Mount Auburn. But Poe's rival stayed silent for one afternoon earlier this month as Poe emerged for a reading of his works at Story Chapel.
Down, still unceasingly, still inevitably down. I shrunk convulsively at its every sweep. My eyes followed its whirls, and I saw that some 10 or 12 vibrations would bring the steel in actual contact with my robe. I forced myself to calm down.
Radio Boston's Tim Skoog talked to Rob Villela about his transformation into Poe and about the author's legacy.
The hardest part, and I'm doing this right now for you, is getting the hair just right. Poe had this expansive forehead. I don't quite have the receding hairline that he had, which is fine by me. And then I have to make it look a little disheveled. I don't think it's because Poe himself didn't take care of himself as much as he probably had just taken his hat off right before every photo that was ever taken of him. But at the same time, you know, I think he's more recognizable when he's a little bit less clean cut. And all I gotta do now is put on the outer coat, and I'm pretty much there.
I know you're eager to see the man of the hour back from the dead, Edgar Allan Poe.
The story is called The Pit and the Pendulum. I was sick unto death with that long agony. And when they at length unbound me and I was permitted to sit, I felt that my senses were leaving me. The dread sentence of...
I like the literature. That's what really drew me to Poe to begin with. Not his story. I mean, I think his story is interesting, but his story is problematic, too, because there's so many inaccuracies out there. There are so many myths associated with him. And you'll see my program, I do mostly just reading the works, trying to expose people to the literature.
The Red Death had long devastated the countryside. No pestilence had ever been so fatal or so hideous. Blood. Blood was its avatar and its seal, the redness and horror.
I think what Poe did that was a little different was he added another level. It wasn't just a straightforward spooky story or gory story. Poe really created things like psychological horror, for example. So it's less about the murder and more about the murderer. It's not just that he's trying to spook people. He's really trying to delve into a kind of a human nature, the negative side of human nature.
The 1,000 injuries of Fortunato I had borne as best I could. But when he ventured upon insult, I vowed revenge. He had a weak point, this Fortunato. He considered himself
I call myself a Poe apologist or a Poe sympathizer, so my version of Poe is a little bit more cleaned up than most people expect him to be. So I don't believe, for example, that he was a drug addict. There's really no evidence of that. I believe that his alcoholism is something that he strove to control rather than let it control him. I actually find that some people who are Poe fans find that a little disappointing about him, that he wasn't this raving, drug-addled, alcoholic lunatic.
I continued, preparing to place the final bricks. For the love of God, Montresor! Yes, I said. For the love of God. The half of a century, no mortal has disturbed the tomb I created for Fortunato. May he rest in peace.
I think the argument would have been in those days, if you were a good person, you wrote uplifting literature that made you a better person. And if you were a bad person, you didn't. And I think Poe's rivals were really trying to portray him as somebody whose literature could harm you because he himself was not a good person. He also dies in October 7th, and there's all kinds of other things associated with October. But of course, Halloween is the biggest thing. I don't think Poe would have celebrated Halloween the way we do today. But I think he would get a kick out of the fact that we celebrate him for Halloween today. One of my big fears in doing this is that I'm going to do it wrong and turn somebody off to Poe. My real goal is to turn people on to Poe so that maybe they take that next step to learn a little bit more, to read something new and something different, not just the standard Telltale Heart and Raven kind of works. That's my real hope, that people will get inspired and encouraged to dig in a little more. No pun intended, I'm at a cemetery.
That's literary historian Rob Villela. He spoke with Radio Boston's Tim Skoog at Mount Auburn Cemetery earlier this month. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell, with help from Eve Zuckoff and Walter Wuffman. Tim Skoog is our technical director, with engineering today by Max Liebman. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.